today I'm here with Alex from PetFlow. Alex has, I guess, a fairly illustrious history starting Azugel, and has done a lot of different things, and it's actually really hilarious that Alex is doing a pet food business, and I've read a little bit about it, and I think the reasons that he's doing it are really interesting. Because I'm just going to say what I think before I let Alex speak, because I just do think it is really interesting that we had the pets.com in the late 90s that ended up in a big explosion. But I know a bit about Alex's background, and he's a direct response guy. So if he's doing a pet supply business, it's not because the business is glamorous, it's because he's figured out the metrics to make it work. Anyway, so Alex, I'm sorry to take over your introduction, but maybe if you could start off and tell us a bit about yourself.
So I founded a company called Azugel Ads, which was a very popular performance-based network. That business grew tremendously from the time that we started 2002 until 2005, at which point we sold a big piece of the company to a private equity firm. Stuck around for 5 years after that with my co-founder, Joe Spicer, at which point we started looking at new and interesting ideas. We had a whiteboard of those new and interesting ideas, and it just so happened that at that time, my girlfriend called me and she said, "You're out of dog food." And I said, "You're out of dog food." She says, "You're out of dog food." So I had to run to a corner store to get food for my dog, and of course the store didn't have it, and it was 7 o'clock and every other store was closed. So I did not feed my dog that night, and I said, "That's a problem, and I wish there was a place where I can just go and order this food online." And when I went online to try to find it, there was a site that was willing to sell it to me. They were selling it for cheaper than the local store did. However, I had to pay a $15 shipping fee to get it delivered to my house, which seemed astronomical to me. So I tried to find other stores where I could do the same thing. And again, there was a huge shipping fee where they didn't even have the product. So I said, "There's something here. Let's see if people would be open to signing up to have regularly scheduled deliveries of their pet's favorite food delivered to their home." And so we put up a simple landing page, tested whether it would make sense for people to sign up. We had an overwhelming response to that, and we said, "We're onto something, and let's build it." That was 2 years ago, and so where we are today is we own PetFlow.com, which has been growing phenomenally well, and knock on wood, is now our new baby.
So let's go back to Azugel. What did you do before Azugel?
You know, Joe and I co-founded, I actually ran a coupon site. It was called BigBigSavings.com. Joe ran a site called DealProvider.com, and it was kind of similar to Retail Me Not, which is very popular today. We posted coupons from Staples, Barnes & Noble, all kinds of stores, and just got paid through affiliate links, and that's how we met each other. We met each other online, said, "Let's pool our links together so that we can get a higher revenue share from the partners with whom we work," and that was, you know, through BeFree, through Commission Junction, Linkshare. And then at that time, there was a whole bunch of other guys that had similar websites, so we started working together with them, and so we kind of started building this informal network. You know, prior to that, I was in college, when I was graduating from college, I actually got a job at Imperial Oil, which was going to pay me a glamorous $45,000 a year. And so after I got the job, I started this coupon savings website. And lucky for me, by the time I actually had to start the job, so I got hired in November. I was supposed to start working in May. By the time I started working, my coupon site was making more in a month than I was going to make in a year at Imperial Oil. So I made the very difficult decision not to take the full-time job.
And you guys have done a fair bit with email, have you not?
Yeah. So we after we did the shopping website, email was getting big. There was a company called Postmaster Generals that delivered email for pretty much everybody, and we were spending, God, I think it was $3,000 or $4,000 a month to send an email to like 20,000 people that has subscribed to receive our coupons. And we said, you know, it can't cost that much. It should be a lot cheaper. So that's kind of how Azugel came about. And we built this email platform that we started using ourselves, and our cost went from like $3,000 or $4,000 to $200 or $300. So of course people started saying, hey, how can I, you know, I want to do the same. I want to leave Postmaster General, move to Azugel. And so this email platform kind of developed. And that, we ran that for about a year and a half, at which point in that space, it's, you need more servers to be able to send more email. I know nothing about technology. I was forced to learn a little bit of coding. I was sitting on the server and killing sessions, as they crashed, because there was too much email going through those servers. So that we decided that was not the business that we wanted to be in.
Did you make good friends with Stamhouse during that time?
Yeah, that was a fun experience. The interesting thing is we just had a technology that sent out email. I mean, like, you can sign up with anybody. You can send email to whoever you want, and you'll have the same problems today that we did yesterday. Just, you know, your name. My name was the one that showed up on Stamhouse. And that was probably another reason why we didn't want to have any to continue in that business.
So you moved from email, and that helped you build Azugel into running a traffic brokering platform for people.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I mean, that did. I guess in the end, that hasn't. It's had some troubles as of more recently, but I mean, Azugel, back when I remember that space, was a real powerhouse.
Yeah, look, when we built, I'll be perfectly honest, Attractive at that time was the market leader, and they were doing certain things right, certain things wrong, and we wanted to build something that we would have wanted to use ourselves. So, you know, up until that time, up until we really started, the only way to get campaigns was through agencies, and the agencies had a very cavalier attitude towards working with publishers, and it was, I will pay you if and when I get paid. And that if and when created a lot of doubt and a lot of uncertainty, and it was very hard to get statistics. You didn't know, you know, when you were making money, how much money you were making. So we built, you know, a Azugel Ads when it started. Everything was in real time. You get a click, you refresh, that click showed up. You get a sale, that sale showed up immediately. So, you know, those are the kind of statistics that we wanted to have for ourselves. You know, on top of that, your relationship was with Azugel, and Azugel's relationship was with the advertisers. So, you know, we paid you on the 15th of the month, and it was our job to get to collect from advertisers.
Which usually works out.
Usually does work out, yeah.
So it's interesting. I mean, you build Azugel into a pretty cool business. I didn't hear of many other networks going the private equity route like you did, and that's
yeah.
Really interesting to me. Like, can you talk about some of the numbers behind that and how you felt about that in hindsight?
Yeah, look, hindsight is a difficult thing. Joe and I, thankfully, again, knock on wood, we've done very well. In hindsight, we probably could have done better if we had just maintained control of the company and maybe sold for a bigger number to a strategic. You know, it's one of those decisions that you make as an entrepreneur, and, you know, I remember going to one of the ad tech shows, and, you know, we were being courted by all sorts of private equity and VC, and, you know, we were sitting down, I remember one of the Hyatt or something like that, and the guy that we were talking to said, look, you know, whether you take money from me or not, I will tell you, you know, one thing that you should do, and that's take some chips off the table, because it'll make your life a whole lot better, having that nest egg that you never have to worry about. And it was kind of, you know, it's a typical one in the hand, two in the bush scenario where, you know, whatever you get to keep. And you leave the rest for the come. And that's kind of, and then so, you know, when we came away from that meeting, we said, okay, you know what, let's do something. Yes, maybe, you know, we get the first bite of the apple now. The second bite is an uncertainty, but at least you got that first bite. Now, granted, the company at that time was making a whole lot of money, so we were, you know, we would still be able to pull a lot of cash out of the business if we had wanted to. But, you know, when you do that, you kind of sacrifice future growth. So, it's, again, one of those decisions you make as an entrepreneur if you're presented with it, you know, and if there's other entrepreneurs that are in a similar situation, I would urge them to kind of do the same.
Well, I mean, so we're a lot of years after this all happened now. Can you tell some of the specifics in terms of the numbers? Like, what were your revenues at the time and what kind of deal you had to offer and how much you guys walked away with?
It's public knowledge. It was $48 million that we got. And the revenue of the company at that point was about $64 million. We projected $48, so we probably got a little less than we should have. And the following year, we did just about $100 million, and the company kept going after that.
And so you guys stayed with the company, and then so how does that work in terms of control of the company, and what like influence did the investors have over the business?
Yeah, so the investors had board seats, and they, you know, at the beginning, obviously, at that point, we were at about 60 employees, and certainly Joe and I know a whole lot more about running businesses today than we did back in 2005 when we sold the company, but we wanted to bring in a professional management team because, you know, at that point, once you take private equity money, the goal of the company is to continue growing and then hopefully be acquired by somebody. And so the way you usually get that done is you bring in quote-unquote gray-haired CEOs and COOs and the general counsel, and you build in a professional management team, which is what we did. So we brought in a full management team, and the company continued to grow.
Oh, so you guys more or less stepped back a bit, did you?
We stepped back a lot. When we get asked these days, what were you doing at Azugal Ads in the last couple of years? And I usually say that we were quote unquote firefighters. If there was some sort of a problem, we would try to figure it out somehow. If there was an advertiser or a publisher that needed help, we would work with that advertiser or publisher, and there's a lot of institutional knowledge that we had in terms of how to get campaigns to work, and that's what we were assisting with.
But your main job at that point was figuring out how to spend $48 million.
I haven't spent a whole lot of that. I didn't take a vacation the day that the investment closed, and I didn't buy a new car, so nothing really in my lifestyle changed whatsoever after that.
That's interesting. And so the hope was then that the professional managers would then continue to build the company, and then a few years later there would be a strategic sale somewhere else, and that would then release the rest of the equity to you guys.
Correct.
But it didn't work out that way, so now in hindsight it's like a lot of CPA networks also went down too, so you guys may have actually still done the smartest decision.
Absolutely. Yeah, look, like I said, hindsight is always perfect, right? And things could have been different if we had stayed the course. You know, the one drawback to taking VC money or selling a piece of your company to a private equity firm, a private equity firm is not looking just to get their money back. They want their money back and then some, and usually that then some is a whole lot more. So when you take an investment from somebody, your exit of value has to be significantly greater at which compared to the value at which you raised money or sold equity. So your options become limited. Limited insofar as you have to hit that new higher threshold. Because if we sold at about $120 million valuation, we needed to sell the next time around at like $250 or $300. Those are big numbers to hit. So in hindsight, maybe if we just kept running it ourselves, somebody would have bought the entire company for $100 a year down the road or a year and a half down the road. But again, hindsight is perfect, and there's no way to know if that would have or not would not have happened.
So it's interesting that you guys have taken a turn. Like you're not heading back into the ad tech space. You're going into building more of a startup and raising money. Why the change?
When we got into this, we wanted to control something end to end. It was the days of Azugal, or even just anybody who's in the ad tech space. You're really relying on a whole lot of other people to make your business tick and to make your business work and to make sure that you're able to pay your bills. If an advertiser doesn't pay, you're screwed. If a publisher does something wrong, you're screwed. This business, we have our own warehouse, we've got our own customers, we buy products from suppliers that we warehouse, that we sell. So it's up to us to mess something up in order to cause some sort of damage to our business. And that's what's really exciting about this. This business is we get to control the entire thing. And we have, when you compare this to the advertising world, I always say we were kind of the you know, the invisible force behind the banner or the email or the search result that somebody saw. Nobody knew who we were. So if you asked a million consumers, you know, who's Azuga Ads, nobody will be able to tell you it. Nobody will be able to give you an answer. You know, the difference here is my box that arrives at a customer's home has our logo, has the words petslow.com very clearly marked on that box. When the person opens that box, they're taking the food that's in that box and feeding it to what they consider their children. So it's a very rewarding and different experience running this company or even any company where you're selling a physical good and you've got real customers. And it, you know, it's a completely different experience. And that's something that we were looking for when we were looking for to start new companies. We didn't really want to rely on other people, because in the Azuga days, we were relying on both our advertisers and our publishers to make sure that we stayed in business. And that's not what we wanted to do here.
And so what other businesses were you evaluating at the time when you found the idea of PetFlow?
I mean, it was everything. We looked at all kind of different subscription models, even you know, going and competing against like a Netflix with some sort of a DVD club or a shopping platform where you could aggregate sales from all kinds of different online stores. We definitely wanted to stay within the e-commerce space, and we wanted to provide a value to a customer. You know, every day we were looking at interesting things. You know, when we started Azuga, you can call us kind of like the first CPA network, but, you know, there were other platforms that enabled for CPA transactions. So we didn't invent CPA, we just, you know, made it better. We made it easier for publishers to work with a network. We made it easier for advertisers to work with a network. So we were looking across the web at interesting ideas that we could potentially improve on. You know, pet food was being sold online. Pet Food Direct is a company that's been around for 12 years. They were the company that went to charge me that huge shipping fee. So, you know, there's no shortage of people willing to sell pet food. It's just we didn't think anybody was doing it right. So, you know, when we built Azuga, we used no off-the-shelf software whatsoever, except for maybe PHP and MySQL. So we built everything from scratch. We've done the same thing with PetFlow.
Who wrote all your code for Azuga?
We had two brilliant guys named Ben and Bogdan, who happened to be, I think, 21 when they started working for us. So it was two guys, and that tech team swelled to, I think, about 40 people. At the height of our Toronto office, when we had 125 of staff there.
Those guys sure as hell did their job.
They definitely did, and you know, we rewarded them, actually. 10% of the money that we got from our investors went directly to our employees.
And so you mentioned, and I want to get into the specifics of how you tested the original idea for PetFlow, but how many other ideas got to that stage where you actually made a landing page and did some tests?
You know, this was the one. When I got that call from my girlfriend telling me we were out of pet food, and I'm online all day, so I can pretty much find anything online. When I had a hard time finding what I needed, I said there's a reason why that's happening, and that reason was that this industry has kind of been devoid of investment for the last decade. And so when we kind of landed on this one, a light went off and said, okay, we're onto something. Let's start building.
Can you walk us through the test? Like, was it one landing page? Like, what was the sequence of pages
together
in your initial test?
So we put together one landing page. At the beginning, it actually said, would you be, save up to 25% on pet food delivered right to your door, on scheduled pet food delivery. It's pretty direct about the fact that you're signing up for some sort of an auto ship platform. And we did a Facebook test. We threw some flyer traffic at it. And I think we had at least a 10% conversion rate, which was, you know, pretty high considering most other lead gen is, you know, in a 3-5% range. So we saw a pretty good response rate to the lead form. And obviously, you know, what the thank you page said, thank you, we're not ready yet. We'll let you know where we are. So we actually had angry customers, potential customers, emailing us saying, where the hell is the damn dog food? And so we actually, that happened in December of 2009, and it took us until July of 2010 to actually have a working site for people to be able to order from. And when I say working, I use that word very kindly.
But so your initial test then was a lead gen. Like, how many fields on the lead gen was it?
it was, you know, first, last, city, state, zip. We wanted to make it involved enough so that we weren't just getting, you know, yeah, I'm John Smith and give me dog food. It was full postal. I don't think we had any drop downs for, you know, what type of food or dog that you have. We just to see if people would be open. It wasn't so much that we wanted to get people's data to, because, you know, we knew we weren't going to be selling them anything in the for the first little while. It was just to see if people would go through all the hoops of actually giving us their data if they were actually interested.
Was it one page as a lead gen, or was it a
just
couple?
Just a one pager.
And so, and then you're not doing anything against FTC rules, because you're notifying them right away that, you know, that maybe you said something like that they can sign up, but they'll be notified when your service is ready and that kind of
stuff. Yeah, the thank you page says, thank you very much for providing your information. We are currently working on building Petflow. As soon as we're ready, we're going to notify you at the email address you provide. And I think our first 1,000 people that filled it out got a pretty hefty discount. So,
that's great.
Yeah.
And so you do that, and then you're like, holy cow, this is converting really well. And so then what, you spend the next 6 months figuring out how you're going to actually sell the stuff?
Yeah, so we were initially going to partner
before we do that, on the lead gen, I mean, it implied that they were going to be paying a monthly subscription. I mean, what was the, what, how
significant it just said, would you be open to, you know, I don't remember exactly what the headline was, but it was regularly scheduled pet food delivery service at up to 25% off of retail. You know, click here to sign up. And so when they filled out that form, they clicked, that was it. And so we wanted to test the concept of, do people really want to subscribe to have pet food delivered? Right? Cause I'm, you know, up until that time, I literally, you know, I don't know if you have any pets.
I don't.
If you have a cat or dog, it's a chore. You go to the store whenever you're out, and it's kind of annoying, because if you feed your dog or cat a premium category of food, you usually can't find that at Petco or PetSmart, nor can you find it at your local grocery store. So you end up having to go to a small store. Those small stores manage their inventory by clipboard, so it's up to them to make sure that they have the product in stock. Many times they don't. And so it's a really annoying shopping experience for most people to get premium products. So the whole notion of signing up to have this food delivered is something we wanted to see if people would be open to registering and having their food delivered on a regular schedule.
Right.
So that was the most important part of that. It wasn't, you know, we knew that we could sell pet food online. That doesn't take.
But could you sell it? What you wanted to know is, could you sell it to the mass market, and would it convert? And
correct.
Have you heard of the lean startup movement from Eric Ries in Silicon Valley?
I have not.
It's funny, actually. So I guess maybe 8 years after, you know, you guys were working on all of this stuff, one of the guys in Silicon Valley, he's a really smart guy, and there's a whole movement in the startup space called the lean startup movement, which is focused around what you would be describing here as the minimum viable product and testing a new business idea very quickly. That's exactly what you did here, and I'm very interested in it, and a lot of people don't realize that, you know, we've been doing this sort of thing for a very long time, and you can look into, you do a search for like words like pivot. They've got their whole language around all of this, and I mean, what you did there is you nailed it in a very short amount of time with a Facebook test as to, is this a valid concept to build a business around? I mean,
yep.
You've even given me the creative that you use, basically, which is regularly scheduled pet food delivery service at up to 10% off retail. Click here to sign up. That's what's enabled you to build a business.
Exactly. Yeah, and it was maybe $1,000 that we spent.
Right, and I mean, that's huge, because if that had bombed, maybe you would have tried some other creatives until you could have found something that worked, but if it really was just looking bad, you would have known that after a few $1,000 and you would have been done.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I did. Look, it was that test that kind of led us into investing millions of dollars of our own personal money into starting this company. So, and I was not aware of the lean startup movement. It makes a whole lot of sense to me just logically.
That's a minimum viable product is what they're what they're doing there, and that's how to do an initial test. And I figured you guys probably hadn't connected across to that community, but that's exactly what they talk about, and but you've done it very elegantly. So why don't you go and tell us then? So after you've got your test, what was the next stage to turning that into a business?
Yeah, so look, we were initially going to partner with somebody that was already in the space. Because look, the last thing I wanted to do is go and start buying pet food. I want to partner with somebody who's already in the space, build the marketing platform behind it, own the customers, own the user experience. Unfortunately, that didn't work out because you really have to own one of these things end to end. If we realize that if we leave the warehousing to somebody else, if we leave the product sourcing to somebody else, we're still going to be at the mercy of somebody else controlling our destiny. So it took us until March to be able to actually have a site. And again, there might be great off-the-shelf software that can power a whole lot of stores. I know Magento is a great one, and a friend of mine is using it for his web store. It did not fit the vision that we had for the company. Our interfaces and our site is very different than most other sites. We kind of built it for the way that we like to shop online. The proceed to checkout button is one of the biggest things on the site. You can add items to your cart without going and looking at the description of those items because many people don't want to look at them. So there, you can purchase from our site in much fewer clicks than you would from other people. And so it took us a while to build this site, again, not using any off-the-shelf software.
Because you've designed a site around conversion.
Correct. Yeah, I mean, that's the world that I come from, is maximizing conversion. In March of 2010, we had the site ready, so we hired our first employee who was charged with sourcing products and maintaining supplier relationships. And
Before you go on, who built the site?
We hired a couple programmers in New York. It's a very tough market to hire programmers, but we're able to get a couple really smart guys.
So you just got a couple of smart guys, and then how did your process work for like designing the site? Did you use mockups?
Joe and I have a decent skill of being able to describe exactly what we want, and so we drew it on a piece of paper. We also, through the days of Azugo, we've worked with a lot of designers, so we happen to have a very good designer that works for us in Toronto. So we asked him, based on, faxing him a copy of exactly what we want the site to look like, he did all of the graphic work, which was then connected to all the database and coding that our programmers did here in New York.
And so that then got the site, a basic version of the site, up and running. And then, have you continued? How do you optimize a site like this?
Oh, it's been. I mean, I had a meeting with a major brand yesterday, and they said that they now have to just take screenshots of our site week after week. We're constantly iterating and constantly changing the site to test if we can get better and better conversion on an ongoing basis. So things are changing, and they're not major things. They're small things that change from time to time, all the time.
Yep. Right. Yeah, I mean, and I think you would take this as a compliment, but I think it's an ugly site. But I imagine it converts really well.
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I mean, we've seen our conversion rate continue to increase from the day that we launched. We've had, partners of ours test our site against others, and they continuously tell us that ours outperforms. So we're doing something right.
So you've built this on a platform that enables you to split test a shopping site. Like, that's kind of interesting. I could imagine that most shopping sites would not be particularly designed to be able to be split tested like this.
Yeah, and we, like I said, we test small elements, small changes make for big differences in conversion.
Right.
It doesn't have to be, they don't have to be monumental changes on your site in order to see if you can get an increase in conversion. We happen to use, I don't know if you're familiar with a company called Monetate. They allow you to add content on a dynamic basis to your site without you bothering your tech team. So if we wanted to add a specific coupon to a specific product when a customer is looking just at that product, we can do that through Monetate. So, you know, there's a bunch of third-party stuff that we use that helps us optimize for conversion. And the site itself is designed in a way that makes for easy purchasing. You know, we removed our nav bar that people used to click on for dog food, cat food, things like that. We're actually adding it back as a source for advertising revenue because brands want to be on there. But our conversion didn't decrease. So, and the search bar is so big, the way that people are used to browsing online is they search. So when they get to our site, they use the search bar. It's the biggest element of the site to find the products that they want. And again, you know, small elements like that, they help. Because I find that when I go to a site and there's just a lot of menu options, I start browsing so much that I never complete my transaction.
Right.
Here you find exactly what you want, and we exit survey our customers. 65% of our customers know exactly what they want when they come to PetFlow. So we want those people to find exactly what they're looking for and check out. The only time we make money is when they check out. There's no ads on our site, so we don't make any more money if there's page views.
I mean, it's very, very well, optimized. I've done a lot of split testing, and you know, like it's great. It's responsive. You got testimonials on there.
Yeah.
So how about the business model? I mean, this is the big joke, right, about the pets.com and the sock puppet and all of this stuff. But, I mean, to me, I thought it was amusing that people would laugh at you because I know that you guys are building this around metrics. But how do the metrics actually back out?
So the metrics do back out. So the difference between us and pets.com is a big one. I actually happened to spend, it was over 2 hours on the phone with Julie Wainwright, the ex-CEO of pets.com. Business Insider did a piece on PetFlow, compared it to pets.com, and sure enough, Julie Wainwright came in and wrote a long response, and then out of that came a phone call that I had done with her. The biggest difference is out of 15,000 SKUs that they sold on pets.com, only 600 were foods. So, and if you look at any of their advertising, you can go on YouTube and search for pets.com commercials, most of their ads were centered around a frisbee, a toy, you know, the tennis ball, the bowl, the dog bowl, or a bed, things like that. Basically non-consumables that the customers really did not need. They were nice to have, but if I bought a dog bed yesterday, I really don't need you to give me discounts on another dog bed for the next 10 years. We started the business in a completely different way. We're selling you products that you have to have. You know, I always say, I just said it an hour ago in a meeting, you can't wake up one morning and say, I'm no longer going to buy this dog food. The only time you would say that is if your pet passed away or if there's a problem with the food that you're feeding, in which case you're switching to another one. But you generally don't just decide, I'm no longer going to feed my dog. As a human being, you could say, I'm no longer going to that restaurant because that restaurant gave me a bad meal, but you'll go to a different restaurant. With a dog, it's different. You have to feed them a stable diet of the food that they're used to, or you can cause all kinds of stomach problems for them.
Well, you did. You left your dog hungry that night, didn't you?
Yeah, I did. Yeah, and the thing is, I didn't want to risk giving her something else. I just, you know, I'll wait. You know, she would wait until tomorrow morning and look at me with hungry eyes for the rest of that evening. So because of that, because of the fundamental difference in the business model, our customers have to have the product that we're selling them. And so what we see is about 50% of our new customers sign up for auto ship on their very first purchase. And the other 50% make a one-time purchase, and then they usually come back to the site and make subsequent purchases on an as-needed basis. But again, these are products that they have to have. And the other difference is we've got 150 different brands that we carry. We've got a lot more brands than the vast majority of other online stores as well as offline stores. When we compare our premium category, we're about three times the size of Petco PetSmart. And that's why they lose so many customers to us. Through our exit survey, we ask our customers where they used to shop before us, and 60% of our customers are ex-Petco and PetSmart shoppers. We have a much more broad basket of goods for that customer to buy, and these are products that they need to have. So we get a lot more orders per year from our customers than other retailers, unless they're doing, you know, a discount a la Fab or Gilt or something like that, where customers are coming because of discounts. We have no discounts on our site whatsoever. The price is the price. That's the price you're agreeing to pay. You don't have to worry. You know, what we find often is the problem with e-commerce, and I think this is why JCPenney kind of went to this whole, you know, this is the price, you'll pay this price no matter when you come to the store, there's never going to be a sale. This is, you know, this is the price that we're charging for this product. It's the same as the Costco model, they mark everything up 15%. Same thing on our site. The prices that you see on our site today are the same prices that are going to be there a week from now or even 2 months from now. So a customer doesn't have to worry about there being some sort of a sale and them missing out on some sort of savings. So that's why our customers are more apt to sign up for the regularly scheduled delivery than they would with somebody else.
So you mentioned 50% of your customers go straight into the continuity.
Yeah.
Do you have retention numbers?
Yeah, I mean, there's no specific numbers that I can share. Those are a little private. But you just have to remember that this is not a, you know, if somebody bought a bag of Origin Regional Red for $87.99. It's because that's a product that they're feeding their pets. And when that food runs out, they don't simply buy something else. They need another bag of Origin Regional Red. So what I always say is it's up to us to lose that customer. And we have lost a lot of customers and pissed off a whole lot of people when we started, when we didn't know anything about shipping heavy dog food across the country. I'll give you a funny example. We were trying to figure out how do we save money on these shipments. So, you know, one of those ways is you decrease the quality of the corrugate that you use. You just use a thinner box. And lo and behold, our damages went way up because the box literally crumbled as soon as the FedEx guy would put it in his truck. So we were saving 10 cents a box, but we were reshipping $80 worth of product, which, by the way, the second time it got there, it was also broken. So, you know, but by the time we figured that out, we said we can spend 30 cents more per box and eliminate $80 worth of cost multiple times. Didn't take very long, but we figured that out. And once we did, our damages went down. So, you know, we made a lot of mistakes when we started. We definitely paid for those mistakes dearly, but I think where we are right now is, you know, the vast majority of our customers are very happy with the service they get from us.
Well, even if your retention now is only 3 months or something, you can still, you've learned how to acquire those customers. You can go back and call them and get them back later, and then you can figure out how to turn that 3 months into 18 months, and then suddenly you've got a killer business.
Yeah, they're along for the ride for a lot more than 3 months. The average age of a pet is anywhere between 11 and 13 years. So theoretically, if we acquire a customer, that customer should be purchasing from us for 11 to 13 years. When we look back at our earliest months, you know, I'll share this stat with you. When we look at our earliest months, and that's, you know, July through September of 2010, after 2 years, we still have over 50% of those customers buying from us.
Oh, wow. And do they just leave it on auto ship?
Exactly, yeah. Dogs don't change. You know, my dog gets a cup of food every single day. If I buy a 15-pound bag of food, which has 30 cups in it, it's reasonable to assume that I need that same bag of food every 30 days. I never, you know, nowadays, thankfully, I don't not feed my dog. So I give her that cup of food every single day. Even if she goes,
it's all going to be like, you know, underweight and malnourished. And
I hope not. But, you know, it's reasonable to assume that every 30 days I'm going to need that 15-pound bag of food. So you just schedule delivery for every 4 weeks, and that bag of food shows up at your door. And that's it.
And then if you've got that relationship, then you can build in upsells. You can do birthday presents to the dog.
So that's the traditional story, right? You start with the consumable. You start with the essentials. It's the same thing that diapers.com did, except they started with diapers, which had a much lower gross margin than pet food does. And so eventually they were able to get those customers to purchase many additional products from them. You know, we're starting to see success in that area as well. Customers actually ask us for different products, and, you know, we're always looking for interesting new products to bring on our site. Right now we have about 6,000 SKUs. At this time next year, I hope that number is closer to 10,000 or 11,000, and the major growth, I think we've got the food covered pretty well. There's still some regional brands that we need to bring on. But the bigger growth is going to be in the non-consumables, because once we're sending that big box of food to your home, and, you know, the dog bowl or the leash and the collar can pretty much ride along for free, so it's no incremental cost to us. And so all of that will be incremental gross margin. And the customers, you know, in aggregate, a certain percentage of customers will need those non-consumables at any given time during the year, and we want to be the place where they get them.
So your basic problem that you've had to solve was how to get big bags of dog food to people at a sustainable rate. And if you can solve that and make the metrics of that work, then you can build out the rest of the business behind it.
Yeah, look, it's been a monumental challenge. We've certainly learned a lot. You know, if you compare my life 2 months ago, which was in the warehouse with dirty shoes and wearing a T-shirt, packing boxes of food to send out to our customers, versus a couple years ago, going to the Playboy Mansion for an online advertising network, the Playboy Mansion seems a lot more glamorous than that. But it's we've learned a whole lot in the last year when we opened our own warehouse, spent time packing boxes, understanding what our customers are buying, understanding which brands move the most. There's a
Do you regret it though? I mean, the Playboy Mansion's calling, and now you're in the
absolutely
warehouse.
Absolutely not. No, I love this. This is I said this just in a meeting prior to this call that. This is our baby. It's a fulfilling experience actually being able to sell products to customers that they really, really want to have and they need to have. And it's not just something that they put in the corner of their house. It's something that they're feeding to their pet. And their pets, for many people, for myself included, they're like our kids. Very fulfilling experience to be able to run this company.
How are you acquiring leads? Are you buying traffic?
They're everywhere. So we do a tremendous amount on Facebook. If you go to facebook.com/petflow, you'll see some of what we do. We get a lot of customers from Facebook. I just did an interview yesterday about our Facebook strategy, and it's working well for us. Google, of course, we buy some display. We do a lot offline as well. So it's the full boat. We get traffic everywhere.
And so it's working. What you're doing is working across mass media.
Absolutely. And look, it's one of those. It's the pitch that I used to give to advertisers is you can't just look at the one channel on its own. You have to look at them all holistically. I see that better than anyone now, because if I buy a print ad. Most people, the way that they search is the way that they go to any company is they'll go to Google and type in the company's name. So, and when they do that and they click on the company's name, sure enough, that sale gets attributed to Google. But did it really come from Google, or was it because the person searched for the company's name because they saw a print ad somewhere? So, doing attribution is kind of difficult when you're advertising across platform and across channels, but we look at everything in aggregate, and we usually we try to map media spend in a particular market with search traffic in that market. You add to that retargeting, then you got an even more complicated ball of wax. But it's all those things together with that. We measure our bottom line CPA. Are we willing to acquire our average customer at this CPA, given the metrics that our business generates? And so far, that answer has been yes.
And so I guess that the problem that you have in this as a business is that it's capital intensive, and so that's why you have to go out and raise money?
Yeah. Customers aren't free, right? And so we forward spend on all our customers. So if my customer makes an $80 order, I don't make $40 on that transaction, especially after shipping fees. I rely on all those future purchases from that customer that I know I'm going to get. We forward spend on media, the key to this business is getting as big as possible, as quickly as possible, because these businesses like this one, are a lot more profitable at scale. So it's very important to get to that scale as quickly as possible, and that's what we're working towards. Because like I said earlier, our customers that purchase from us, they're agreeing to purchase products at a given price, and that price is held steady for that customer. So if we realize any kind of efficiencies on the bottom line, whether through buying discounts of those products, through better shipping rates, or through more efficient distribution channels, those are all savings that drop to our bottom line. So And that's how this company becomes more and more profitable, is through those additional efficiencies. So we need to constantly get more orders out of our warehouses every single month to push that profitability further.
But so this is something then, if you scale it this way, so you're raising money, maybe it's costing you $50 to $100 to acquire every customer, but you know that the retention is going to be, let's say a year to 18 months and possibly 10 plus years, that then, like, the model can scale quite quickly if you inject a lot of cash into it.
Yeah, look, it's a measurement of cost of acquisition versus lifetime value of a customer. So long as you find the point of where those two intersect, and you can continue growing the lifetime value over and above the cost of acquisition, all of that is potential profitability and upside. And so as long as you can, the lower you can reduce the cost of acquisition and the higher you can increase the cost of the lifetime value, the quicker your payback period becomes, and that's what you manage towards. So the quicker we make more money, the quicker we're able to acquire more customers, which in turn makes us more profitable, which in turn makes us spend more money. So it's kind of a virtuous cycle that we're working in right now, and the quicker that happens, the better off you are. So that's one of the reasons why we're raising funding, is to be able to go out and do a little bit more aggressive media. As a startup, you're somewhat cash constrained, and there's interesting tests that we've run that have produced favorable results, and we'd like to continue doing them. But it's a fairly capital intensive endeavor.
So your areas that you can optimize on, so you can optimize on the site, you can optimize on your fulfillment, and then you can optimize on your supply, the cost of supplies. Those would be the ones that you can really optimize on, and then if you do a good job with those, then you get better profits.
Right, and on top of that, we take possession of all of our products. So if we wanted to launch 4,000 new SKUs, we have to buy in those 4,000 new SKUs to bring them into our warehouse. So there's a cost for inventory as well. But we know which products are selling, and we don't have to bring in mass quantities of those products, before we know what their sales are going to look like. So, that part of it, we were probably 4,000 SKUs 6 months ago, or maybe 7 months ago, and we're at 6,000 SKUs now. So, that SKU count has been creeping up to kind of keep up with our sales. And the nice thing is, the more SKUs we add, and it's kind of like one of those duh moments, but the more SKUs we have, the more sales we get, because we have more products to be able to sell to our customers. And the most important thing for us is, because we buy so much media, and we buy offline media in print, and we've even done television, it's up to us to get as many sales from that channel as possible, because most of what we do is not on CPA, which means if I spend $10,000 for a print ad, I need to get as many customers from that as possible, because I'm not getting that $10,000 back. And that's kind of, for me, it's been an interesting experience, considering everything I've done in the past has been CPA. And
so you're out buying print ads, and you don't know what the return on those ads are?
Well, we know through meticulous testing and trying to figure out exactly. We've got our conversion pretty nailed down. We've got creative pretty nailed down, so we know within a certain margin of error what that performance is going to be like, but we don't know it to the dollar like we did with CPA.
But so you're using a creative, for example, in a print ad that you know works, but basically it's just, for you, it must feel like throwing money into the air and hoping some of it comes back.
Yeah, it's more like throwing spaghetti at the wall, seeing what sticks. But look, it's definitely testing. It's definitely exploratory, but most of what we do is tested online first. So we know what the response rate is going to be like before we run a print ad. We pretty much know that our googly eyed pug is going to pull in better than putting a golden retriever on that same ad. So it's I wouldn't say it's fully scientific, but it's a fairly scientific kind of test.
Right. How do you keep your employees excited? Because, I mean, pet food isn't necessarily the most exciting area. I mean, you know, Steve Jobs with Apple and all of that stuff. But so Zappos really focused on their culture and in a very particular way with Zappos and be a little bit offbeat and that kind of stuff. I guess, I mean, you guys are young, so it mightn't be at the stage where you've established a formal culture, but how are you thinking about that?
Look, we even in the Azugal days, we had a very relaxed environment. Our doors are never closed. We're not the bosses of the company. I don't like when people say I work for Alex. I like when people say I work with Alex. And that's kind of the same culture that we have here. I mean, as long as you get your job done, you can come in later and you can leave earlier. No one's going to penalize you for that. But as we continue to grow, I think that culture is going to continue to evolve. We've got 27 people in our Manhattan office and another 25 people in the in Jersey warehouse. So it's going to continue to evolve. But I think, you know, having a comfortable environment where nobody feels like they're pressured to work here has worked well for us in the past, and I think it's going to continue to work well for us in the future.
Cool. Was there anything you want to tell us about which we didn't cover?
No, I think we covered this one in depth. If anybody is starting, their own business, they should love what they're doing. And you asked me earlier about what I did before the Azugal days. It was a difficult decision not to go into the professional career, but I think it was the best decision that I ever made. So that's been pretty awesome, and thankfully that's what's gotten me to where I am today. And when we were talking about the hindsight and having sold to private equity, you can't look back. You only have to look forward. If you question all of your decisions, you'll never make another one. So that's kind of how I look at things.
Yeah, fair enough. All right. Well, thank you very much for doing the interview.
My pleasure.